Welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble! Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right next to Terrible Tommy, Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station.
And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, North Central Indiana. That's where we're at, and it's an overcast day in the heartland, but pretty warm. Hasn't turned winter yet. Yeah. And it's October the 19th, 2016, and we're ready to go. Are you ready to go? This is go to school day. This is go to college day. This is go to university day. We're going to have a course here for you on, guess what? Terrorism. What's it all about? What's it all about? Terrorism. The ins and outs and ups and downs of terrorism. So here we go. Stand by. Get ready.
Strategy. The armies and theaters of war may change, but the classics of strategic thought endure. From ancient Greece to 21st century Afghanistan, strategy is the process of political objectives being met through military action to compel your enemy to bend to your political will. In his course, Masters of War, History's Greatest Strategic Thinkers, Andrew Wilson, professor of strategy and policy at the United States Naval War College, examines powerful strategies that have stood the test of time. Andrew, man has a long history of war. Is there any such thing as new war strategy?
I mean, a lot of that what is new in war is technological.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, new types of weapons, new weapon systems, new venues of military interaction, be it in outer space or in the cyber realm, require new ways of thinking about and using this particular new technology. But it doesn't really change the purpose of war. I mean, war is always about using violence as a means towards achieving your political objectives. So,
is there a commonality to all war?
Well, one of our theorists that we dealt with in Masters of War, said that war is more than a true chameleon. Every war is radically different.
Mm-hmm.
But you could look at each war as the interaction of these three elements between rationality, passion, the irrational forces, and genius, the non-rational forces in war.
Right.
So that's a way to sort of dissect any war you're looking at, even accounting for the radical differences in the character of each war you're facing.
Let's talk about the United States for a minute. We have a civilian commander-in-chief, we have then, of course, the military command. You talk a lot about the relationship between the civilian and military command. Can you talk about that a little bit and how it applies to our version of commanding an army versus historically how that has been approached?
I think the U.S. has probably the best of all possible systems, in which the military is subordinate and responsive to the Constitution, where the president, the head of the civilian government, is also simultaneously the commander-in-chief of the military forces. We abide by that, again, a Clausewitzian idea that war is an extension of politics. The war serves a political purpose, and therefore its political logic derives from what the government is seeking to achieve by it. So we have built into our system, the subordination of the military to political oversight.
Right.
So that's a pretty healthy system. It does sometimes create tensions because sometimes the politicians can ask the military for something that it cannot do, or if they are ignorant of military affairs, can cause trouble. But I think in general our system beats other systems.
Yeah.
Because it does allow for corrections in there.
Is that a uniquely American construct?
I think the United States has developed it fairly fully. It seems to be the countries of Europe have managed to strike this particular balance. But, it's a balance that's really tough, to constitute and then carry forward in practice. I mean, we have it written into our Constitution, we have it written into subsequent legislation, but actually when you come down to the practice of it, it really, really depends a lot on the individuals in play.
The course really covers so much ground historically and a variety of strategies. There's a few fascinating ones, you know, really from the modern theater. You have an interesting lecture on terrorism as a strategy. Can you analyze for me the strategic goals of a terrorist approach to war?
Absolutely. I think I emphasized in that lecture that terrorism might be the most strategic of military instruments in that it's designed, a terrorist act is designed not to degrade military capability or to take a particular hill or piece of you know, real estate, but it's designed to have a direct psychological and political result. So the idea is that you're communicating, you know, the terrorist is attempting to communicate directly with the incumbent government, or quite often in the case of the United States, the democracy or other nations that have suffered the bane of terrorism, trying to affect the population, trying to affect the, you know, the people who are voting for the government to cause them to undertake a change in policy, or in the case of some terrorist attacks, they're designed to induce a violent reaction.
Mm-hmm.
This is an attempt for terrorist movement, which is inherently a weak movement, weak in terms of popular support and weak in terms of material assets. I mean, just the capability to, you know, do anything more than terrorist attacks. You know, they have to get the most, you know, bang for the
effort
they put into it.
Right, yeah, right.
Bang
right.
for the buck.
Yeah.
And the acts itself are designed to be so shocking as to have an outsized political and strategic effect, political, strategic, and psychological effect. I mean, that's, you know, the idea of someone who is so desperate that they would kill themselves in the course of a terrorist act. You know, suicide bombing is designed to sort of alert an audience that, wow, something must be terribly, terribly wrong for these people to lay down their lives. So the shock factor is supposed to be there. You know, there's a lot of debate in Al-Qaeda before 9/11 as to what should their strategic focus be. And there was debate whether they go after the near enemy, which would be the apostate regimes in the region, in particular Pakistan. Should they try to focus their efforts on toppling the regime in Pakistan, or, and this was the decision they made, mm-hmm. would it be of greater strategic payoff if they went after the United States, if they went after the far enemy?
Right.
Because there were two options. If you reached out and struck the far enemy, the United States, if you did it in one particular way that was just so shocking and so psychologically disruptive, you might have induced the United States to, you know, withdraw its support from the region, sort of start to back out of the Middle East and the Muslim world, which would undercut what, you know, Al-Qaeda would thought was a crucial support for the apostate regimes, which is the alliance with the United States. The other potential result would be that the United States would overreact, would come back with a violent response, and that would actually play to Al-Qaeda's narrative, because if you force a overreaction, the United States comes in and starts bombing and blowing up targets, you know, this parallels nicely with Al-Qaeda's message. So you actually induce, you know, an overreaction, either withdrawal or an overreaction. And both of those reactions actually help that particular movement, because one of them, you know, in their eyes, one of them, you know, demonstrates how weak we are, and the other one demonstrates how our strength, you know, we use our strength to abuse, to abuse Muslims.
You're listening to The Great Courses Radio. I'm Ed Leon. Let's take a closer look at terrorism as a war strategy. Here is Andrew Wilson, professor of strategy and policy at the United States Naval War College. This is from his course, Masters of War, History's Greatest Strategic Thinkers. If you're interested in military history, I invite you to visit our new video streaming service, The Great Courses Plus, where you can watch hundreds of military history lectures for free. Just go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/SiriusXM and sign up for a free trial. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/SiriusXM.
As shocking as it sounds, there is an undeniable strategic logic to terrorism. In fact, terrorism might be the most strategic of all instruments of war. I say this because the tactical or operational significance of most terrorist attacks are inconsequential, but their psychological impact, both on the enemy and on the terrorists' would-be supporters, can be enormous. It's equally shocking to realize that movements like Al-Qaeda can draw on abundant literature by and detailed historical records of strategically successful terrorists. In the aftermath of September 11th, there was a lot of interest in working more terrorism into our curriculum at the Naval War College. Given the passions aroused by those attacks, we knew we had to figure out a way for students and faculty to approach the topic objectively. So instead of Al-Qaeda, we could train our analytical energies on the IRA, on Algeria's FLN, and Peru's Shining Path. We could also lean on our masters, right? Clausewitz and Sun Tzu, and especially on Mao, to try to understand the strategic logic of terrorism. But it was a colleague of mine, Professor Bill Fuller, who came up with what I believe to be the best model for objectively and strategically understanding terrorism and for measuring the likelihood that a terrorist movement will achieve its political objectives. Professor Fuller called this model the five audiences of terrorism. And in our opening section, I'll go into each of those five audiences to better understand the purpose and strategic utility of terrorism. And then we'll profile one of history's most cunningly successful terrorists, Michael Collins, and use the five audiences, that matrix, to explain how and why Collins and the Irish Republican Army were able to achieve partial Irish independence. At the end, we'll look at what the five audiences concept and the Irish case might tell us about Al-Qaeda's chances of achieving their political objectives. But what is terrorism? Well, first, I'm going to treat terrorism as distinct from simply terror, things like terror bombing, and terrorism as distinct from insurgency or revolutionary war. Therefore, the first element of the definition is that terrorism is a tool used by political movements, primarily non-state actors. The main strategic instrument employed by these movements are acts of violence directed primarily at civilians. That's terrorism. The second defining characteristic is that these political movements are weak. They are seeking strategic and political effects that are completely out of proportion to their political legitimacy and to their relative economic and military strength. Finally, to meet my definition of terrorism, these movements must make explicit and direct connections between their acts of terrorism and their desired strategic and political effects. They must think strategically about this instrument. So terrorists have political aims, and terrorism is their primary strategic means to achieve those aims. The five audiences model is premised on the idea that terrorism is first and foremost a form of political theater. And there are five audiences that terrorists are trying to influence. The first is the incumbent government, the second, the constituent population, the third, the non-constituent population, the fourth is the members of the terrorist organization itself, the rank and file, and the fifth is international public opinion. And we'll define and analyze each of these five audiences individually. But first, let's make sure we understand what we mean when we say that terrorism is a form of theater or communication. This is not to be glib, but terrorist strategy is a matter of planning and executing attacks that are supposed to elicit the desired responses from each target audience. The additional challenge, or advantage in some cases, is that individual acts will affect different audiences in different ways. This is a challenge because one or more audiences might be affected in a desirable way, but with others, the effects might be counterproductive. At the same time, this can be an advantage because each act can affect multiple audiences simultaneously. Individual terrorist acts can therefore be highly cost-effective. And the chances that a terrorist movement will succeed will hinge on how well their acts, those acts of violence, are crafted to have the desired effects on this range of audiences, and also on how favorable the general environment actually is. In other words, as much as a successful terrorist needs to be a smart strategist, he also needs a favorable operating environment. He needs a fair degree of spontaneous support from the constituent population. He needs physical and political room to maneuver, especially in the local environment. And he needs at least moral support on the international stage. So let's look at the first of our five audiences, the incumbent government. Now, if you're a terrorist, what kinds of messages do you want to communicate to the government, and what kind of responses do you want to get? Your attacks can have psychological, political, and practical effects. For example, psychologically, you can paralyze the government with fear to make it look weak in the eyes of other audiences. You might be trying to force a political solution, right? Enforce the incumbent government to make some sort of political concession. You do that by inflicting unacceptable pain or by threatening more pain if they don't concede. Or you might attack the government to create some practical operating room for your movement. Your attacks there might be geared towards preventing the government from doing some part of its core mission, things like law enforcement and local governance. This can open up areas where you can operate relatively unmolested. Conversely, you might want the government to come at you with everything it's got. You might want to induce an overreaction. How about the second audience, the terrorists' constituent population? Within any constituent population, there's a range of identity choices. Say I live in Algiers in the mid-1950s.
I can be a Muslim. I can be proud of my Algerian heritage. I can also like French movies and French poetry and be a proud citizen of a greater French state. The terrorist movement wants to narrow that range of choices so that as a member of what they view as their natural constituency, my only choice is to be an Algerian nationalist and an Algerian nationalist of their definition. So how can they narrow those choices? Well, they can threaten me directly, and that often works, but that might also backfire. Better yet, they might assassinate an Algerian working for the French. That might intimidate me. They can assassinate a French official who is famously corrupt. That might get me to identify with their cause and look upon them as a benefactor. But what about the third audience, the non-constituent population? In Algiers in the 50s, this would have been the European settlers, the pieds noirs. If you're a terrorist, you want to horrify this population. You might also want to make them critical of the government, or maybe even, in some cases, pressure the government to accede to your demands. Alternately, you might want to induce them to overreact and to take the law into their own hands. This brings us to the fourth audience, the rank and file of the terrorist movement. Sometimes you may want to motivate your members. At other times, you may want to intimidate them. Successful attacks can boost morale and motivate them, but you also need to maintain intense iron discipline and prevent infiltration. So threats of reprisals and demonstration killings of traitors can keep the membership in line. And finally, we have the fifth audience, international public opinion. From this audience, you might want to solicit support, foreign friends who will send you guns and money. In other cases, moral support might be enough, but probably you want a little bit of both. Ideally, you want to get the international community to condemn the actions of the incumbent government. You want international bodies to call for an end to hostilities and for negotiations. Remember, you're still a poor and weak movement, but if you get a foreign government, or better yet, the UN, to treat you as a player, well then, you're punching way above your weight. As a terrorist, you are more likely to succeed if you can get outside audiences to view what you are doing as a necessary evil or as an understandable outgrowth of the policies of the incumbent government. So let's turn to our case study, the Anglo-Irish War of 1919 to 1921, through which the Irish Free State was established. A key figure in this conflict was Michael Collins, a brilliant strategist for whom I have a lot of respect. But Michael Collins was a terrorist, and both his political organization, Sinn Féin, and its military arm, the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, achieved their political objectives primarily through a campaign of purposeful and terror-inducing violence against Irish civilians and the British government. In the 2 years between the Irish Declaration of Independence in January 1919 and the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty in December of 1921, a small and lightly armed group of Irish nationalists, perhaps 5,000 diehards in total, well, they compelled the most powerful nation on earth to grant independence to the 26 counties of Southern Ireland. Handguns, dynamite, and propaganda achieved things for the cause of Irish independence that could not possibly have been achieved by conventional military action or through the ballot box. Major Irish rebellions go back centuries, but our story today begins in 1960 with the so-called Easter Rising. Launched by Irish nationalists, the Easter Rising proved to be a badly planned and poorly resourced revolt in central Dublin. Not only did the Rising fail to spark a nationwide rebellion, the actions of the rebels actually horrified the majority of their natural constituency. In the aftermath of the Rising, however, the British committed an even more egregious and strategically significant mistake. The British took hundreds of the young members of the Irish Volunteers who had participated in the Rising and put them in a huge and largely self-policing prison camp at a place called Frongoch in Wales. As a result, what came to be known as the Irish Republican Army had its first war college. At Frongoch, the prisoners held lectures and seminars on the theory and practice of insurgency and on the lessons learned from the Easter Rising. Frongoch's smartest graduate was Michael Collins. Collins had been 26 at the time of the Rising, a brash, vain, and brilliant young man. He was from a long line of Irish nationalists. At the age of 16, Collins had moved to England and worked in the postal service for nearly a decade. His time in England sharpened his acuity for numbers, and he later raised funds and served as finance minister for the Irish Republic. But that decade also gave him an intense familiarity with British government and with British politics. As a result, Collins knew his future enemy very, very well. After the Rising, Collins was imprisoned for 6 months before returning to Ireland in late 1916. In late 1918, Collins ran on the Sinn Féin ticket and won election to the British House of Commons. But Collins and the other 73 Sinn Féin candidates who had won seats refused to be seated in the British Parliament. Instead, they formed an Irish Parliament, proclaimed an Irish Republic, and declared war on Britain.
Over the next 2 years, Collins served as the chief financier, the chief intelligence officer, and a chief strategist for the Republic. At the end of the war, he got the additional job of serving as the lead negotiator with the British government. On the other side of the table was Winston Churchill. Yes, Winston Churchill negotiated with terrorists. Something of an instinctive Clausewitzian, Collins realized that by the summer and fall of 1921, the IRA was at or past its culminating point of the attack. There was very little else that they could do militarily. He also knew that they were probably at their culminating point of victory. In other words, if they pushed London too hard for more political concessions, the British might walk away. David Lloyd George has said as much. If that happened, the British might restart a war that the Irish were destined to lose. So Collins accepted a compromise settlement that left the six counties of Ulster under British control. This is the province of Northern Ireland today. Maximalists within Sinn Féin hated this compromise. And this is often the case with insurgencies and especially terrorist movements. A civil war broke out between the maximalists and the pragmatists. The Irish Civil War of 1922-23 turned out to be far bloodier than the war against the British. Collins was among the casualties. He was gunned down in an ambush in August 1922. And if you're interested, there's a pretty good movie called Michael Collins, starring Liam Neeson.
You're listening to The Great Courses Radio. Here's more with Andrew Wilson, Professor of Strategy and Policy at the United States Naval War College. This is from the course Masters of War, History's Greatest Strategic Thinkers. You'll find many more lectures and courses about military history on our new video streaming service, The Great Courses Plus. Visit thegreatcoursesplus.com/SiriusXM to sign up for a free trial. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/SiriusXM.
Fortunately, we don't have a master of terrorism. But if someone were to write the book on how to be a strategically effective terrorist, it would have been Collins. And we have every reason to fear the next Michael Collins. So let's look at how Collins managed the five audiences of terrorism. First, the incumbent government. In this case, the British government and its instruments of rule in Ireland. Terrorism is a violent negotiation. In order to win in those negotiations, you need to have a good idea of how your adversary is going to react. Collins knew that Ireland was too politically and too strategically valuable for London to give it up without a fight. Collins also knew that the British had two means of holding on to Ireland, civilian governance and military occupation. London was unlikely to opt for military occupation, at first at least, because that would legitimize Sinn Féin. As grandiose as these claims were, by standing up a Republican government and a Republican army, Sinn Féin was claiming sovereignty and legitimacy that were out of all proportion to its actual power. If Britain rose to that bait and either declared war or opted for a highly militarized response, then they would have tacitly accepted the Irish claims of statehood. He also knew that the most effective counterintelligence unit that the British had was civilian law enforcement. This included the Royal Irish Constabulary and the Dublin Metropolitan Police. The RIC and the DMP in 1919 were everything that the Algiers police force wasn't in 1956. The Irish police were well-staffed, well-resourced, and highly professional. They had both English and Irish officers with lots of local knowledge and lots of sources within Sinn Féin's constituent population. In terms of manpower and assets, the police had the upper hand in the intelligence battle. Collins was out to shift that balance and to attack the British strategy by effectively declaring war on the police. In 1919, Collins sets up what's called the Squad, or also known as the 12 Apostles. The squad's job was to intimidate and murder the most effective officers in the DMP and the RIC, and to murder civilians who cooperated with the police. That campaign of terror did a lot to give the IRA operating room in Dublin. Collins claimed that he could sit right next to a police officer in a pub and on a city tram, and they would be too terrified to do anything about it. In November 1920, the squad boldly gunned down several British officers, a move that did as much to shift the intelligence battle as it did to advertise the power and pervasiveness of the IRA. As much as he blinded the police, Collins recruited inside the police. He recruited agents to alert him of counterintelligence operations and to police spies within his own camp. Is it that weren't enough? In April 1919, Collins and a group of men broke into the police intelligence headquarters in Dublin, and Collins spent hours poring over the details of what the police knew about the IRA, and more importantly, how they knew it. Collins undermined London's faith in the police force and denied them intelligence-intensive solutions to the Irish problem. Collins' victory in the intelligence war left the British with only coercive and indiscriminate options. Collins famously argued that the worse the reprisals that the British visited upon the Irish people, the better it was for the cause of Irish independence. He had already induced some members of the police into murderous counter-terror, and in 1920, the British doubled down and began beefing up the ranks of the IRC and the DNP with auxiliaries recruited from English, Scots, and Welsh veterans of the Great War. Unfamiliar with police work and hostile to the Irish, these auxiliaries became famous for their indiscriminate attacks, attacks on innocents in the name of flushing out the IRA. Their dark tunics and khaki trousers earned them the nickname Black and Tans. So across the board, the squad succeeded in having precisely the effect Collins wanted on the British government. For the price of a few hundred guns, a few thousand rounds of ammunition, and some cases of dynamite, Collins had attacked British strategy, forced them into a cycle of violence, and induced them to militarize the conflict. We've also seen that Collins was careful not to push things too far. Collins was looking for the perfect balance of frustration and exhaustion from London, not a blood vendetta. As such, he was very sensitive to the non-constituent population, especially the people back in England. He wanted to calibrate the terrorism campaign to keep them largely neutral, or at best, critical of the British conduct of the war. Collins knew enough about English society to know that the British press would advertise the gory details of the Irish crisis and advertise them to a population that was tired of war and of bloodshed. The non-constituent population in Ireland was, however, another matter. These were the Ulstermen. And the Ulstermen were a tactical and operational problem for Collins, especially with their private army and their ruthless attacks on the IRA and Sinn Féin members. But as it turns out, their excesses turned out to be a strategic asset that drove neutral Irishmen closer to Sinn Féin and that tarnished the image of British rule. When it came to the constituent population, Collins was brilliant and brutal. Among the Irish, there was a huge variety of identities. In fact, at the time of the Rising, most Irish citizens were somewhat sympathetic to the cause of independence, but not passionately so. As a result, Sinn Féin in 1915-1916 was a fringe political party. But by 1921, it was the only party recognized as the voice of Irish nationalism. That shift had not been spontaneous. Collins could tolerate neutrality among the constituent population, but tried to overcome it with an aggressive propaganda campaign. What he couldn't tolerate were pro-British sympathies and active support for British rule. Irish collaborators were intimidated and some were murdered in high-profile ways to frighten anyone with pro-British sympathies. Even when the police nabbed one of the squad, no witnesses would come forward to support the government's case. Collins was equally strategic when it came to the rank-and-file members of the IRA. He worked hard to keep morale up, and he advertised the exploits of the squad to highlight IRA successes and power. He also made sure that traitors within the IRA were rooted out and dealt with summarily and publicly. As to the last audience, international public opinion, there the IRA didn't have to work that hard. Sinn Féin had a large and loyal constituency in the United States. Eamon de Valera, president of the Irish Republic, had been born in New York and spent much of 1919 and 1920 in the United States, where he raised over $5 million. Sinn Féin plowed $500,000 worth of that money back into both sides of the 1920 U.S. presidential election. These activities notwithstanding, the international environment was also exceptionally favorable to Sinn Féin, especially with Woodrow Wilson's calls for national self-determination. In one of his least strategic moments, Collins proposed kidnapping President Wilson and forcing the Irish issue at the Versailles Conference. Fortunately for the Irish cause, cooler heads prevailed. So here we have the strategic logic of terrorism as carried out by one of history's greatest strategic terrorists, Michael Collins. In fact, it's his strategic brilliance that in part makes Collins such a scary individual. It gets even scarier when you realize that terrorists study other terrorists and learn from their successes and failures. But before we start panicking about Al-Qaeda finding their Michael Collins, let's think about the context in which Collins was operating. His adversary, the incumbent government, was weary and distracted. It was fresh out of a horrifically costly and protracted war. At the same time, the British Empire was larger in 1919 than at any time in its history. As a result, the Army and Navy were distracted by a raft of small wars and imperial policing missions from Palestine to Iraq to India to Afghanistan. British means and British will were therefore divided. Ireland may have been valuable, but how valuable relative to all of those other competing demands? Like their government, the British people were weary, distracted and conflicted about the Irish crisis. Meanwhile, the non-constituent population of Ulster, like the British government, proved to be a highly cooperative adversary, basically acceding to Collins' strategic script. When it comes to the Irish people, Sinn Féin offered a political objective, an Irish republic, which had wide appeal to a large and natural constituency. And the rank and file of the IRA was smart, motivated, well-informed, and well-led. Their institution was also highly resistant to penetration by counterintelligence. Finally, the sympathies of a major foreign power, the United States, were with the cause of Irish independence. So if we fast forward to the global war on terrorism, we definitely see some parallels. Yes, the United States may be tired, cash-strapped, and distracted, but nowhere close to the situation that the British found themselves in 1920. Furthermore, we've seen that bin Laden's assumptions about the United States and its allies are deeply flawed. He doesn't really know his enemy very well, or didn't know his enemy very well. The non-constituent population, the vast majority of Muslims that do not ascribe to bin Laden's vision, they're implacably hostile to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's objectives are grand and appealing to some in the Muslim world, but in fact their natural constituency is actually only a very narrow subgroup of a subgroup of Sunni Islam. Pro-independence elements in Ireland, well, they tracked very closely with the ultimate geography of the Irish Free State. Al-Qaeda has territorial fantasies that are out of all proportion to its very, very narrow constituent base. In addition, the narrowness of Al-Qaeda's appeal is evident in the fact that Al-Qaeda in Iraq was betrayed and destroyed by fellow Sunnis. What about the rank and file? Well, some members of Al-Qaeda have been frighteningly impressive, especially the perpetrators of the September 11th attacks. But post-9/11 Al-Qaeda is not nearly as impressive or disciplined, and like all terrorist groups, is prone to infighting and implosion. Finally, with the exception of certain military and intelligence services in a few countries, which I will not name, international public opinion and all of the great powers are also implacably hostile to Al-Qaeda. So I'm not saying that terrorists and strategies that employ terrorism are a thing of the past. Terrorism, and here I mean the individual acts of violence, well, they're actually pretty easy to pull off. Small groups of highly motivated terrorists can temporarily paralyze the most advanced societies, while other terrorist movements can still wrest concessions from great powers. But in the near term, these movements, even if they do find their Michael Collins, are unlikely to enjoy conditions that are sufficiently favorable to allow them to radically alter the regional or the global balance of power.
I'm Ed Leon. You're listening to the Great Courses Radio. I'm talking with Andrew Wilson, professor of strategy and policy at the United States Naval War College. We're talking about viable strategies for combating terrorism. So drawing from history's examples of military strategy, what are the range of viable strategies for government like the United States to combat these kinds of terrorist, you know, blow-ups?
There's a whole range of potential strategies. You know, it depends where the, you know, where the organization is operating. If they are ensconced in ungoverned space, the tribal areas of Pakistan or some ungovernable frontier region between two sovereign entities, and there's no rule of law out there, you know, you're kind of stuck. You know, the military is probably your primary instrument. But if you have a terrorist organization, for example, operating, you know, in a major urban area where there is rule of law, and it would be completely unproductive to call in the military to militarize that response in a venue like that. If you have, for example, the law enforcement capability and the intelligence gathering capability within law enforcement, that's a place where you probably want to treat the terrorist threat as a law enforcement problem. I think we had a very unhelpful debate in the U.S. since 9/11 about whether you treat terrorism as a law enforcement problem or whether you treat it as a military problem. Well, the answer is it depends. It depends where the movement is. It depends what your goals are. Vis-a-vis the movement, depends what the movement is seeking to achieve itself. In some ways, by militarizing a conflict in a civilian zone where there should be civilian government, that actually sort of helps the terrorist movement sell its message that the government is illegitimate and is actually engaged in a military occupation of these places.
I guess you can't do nothing, or can you do nothing? Is that a military strategy, do nothing?
Doing nothing is an option. I mean, because these movements want you to pay attention to them. In some ways, ignoring them satisfies your desire not to give them any credit, but at the same time, lack of action plays to their narrative of you being either weak or illegitimate.
Speaking of militarization, your course also deals with the failure sometimes of air campaigns. And I think there's sort of a hawkish sort of thinking that there's a panacea of we'll just bomb these people into the desert, you know, and into rubble. Is that a viable approach, historically speaking, that airstrikes really have a significant impact on military outcomes?
I think I would say that when it comes to military outcomes, that's probably where airstrikes can have the most significant impact. I'd say where things get a lot murkier is in terms of a significant impact on political outcomes. So if, for example, you know, if I want to stop a cross-border invasion, you know, by one army, that army has to mass. They have to move down the roads and creates a target-rich environment. I can actually use air power in a fairly decisive way to have a specific military outcome. But if I want to, you know, change the behavior of a state, if my focus is on fairly specific and in some cases arcane political outcomes, it's very, very difficult to match, you know, what you're doing militarily in terms of air power to what you're seeking to do politically.
You also cover and review some of the strategies from the Cold War. Can you talk about those a little bit, and are there any lessons that are applicable today?
You know, a big part of the Cold War was nuclear strategy. And I mean, to be honest, nuclear strategy gives me kind of a headache because what you're pondering is like the worst things imaginable.
Right.
And yet the idea that, you know, during the Cold War, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States had this monstrous capability to end, you know, not just the other regime, but basically life as we know it on the planet, so that no one in their right mind would start along the escalation cycle that would lead to a war like that. Now, that model doesn't really help when you're dealing with, you know, newly emerging nuclear powers like North Korea, which has nuclear weapons, or Iran, which, you know, may be pursuing nuclear weapons, because what they want to do is sort of a minimum or limited deterrence approach. They want to have a strike capability. So, for example, if a war starts and the United States decides to drop nuclear weapons on them, they'll have something that'll survive that they could retaliate with. So here's a state that is basically saying, we're not going to win a nuclear war. You're going to wipe us out, but we'll make you pay for that particular action. You know, when you have regimes, in particular, like North Korea, who seems so highly unpredictable and so almost pathologically self-destructive, can hope that this is the way they're thinking about it.
Right.
And that their position of nuclear weapons is just about them making them feel more secure. And if they feel more secure, then the region will be more secure.
So is the complexity of modern, you know, I was going to say modern war, but it's not even modern war. It's like modern danger. increased so much so that it's, I mean, is this unprecedented complexity that we find ourselves in now?
It can look like a complete, you know, blooming buzz and confusion that you're dealing with, because as you start to lay on these technological issues, when you start to lay on these, you know, all these different schools of nuclear strategy, all these different potential adversaries, all the different audiences at play, and then you have the media involved in it, and then you have other countries. I mean, it starts to look like, how could you possibly make any sense of this? So you say, well, then, okay, what is the value of trying to think strategically, trying to think systematically through these issues? And I think it actually proves the opposite, which is the more complex things get, the more starting from the simplest concepts, like this idea of this Clausewitzian trinity, that all war is this dynamic tension between those three forces, gives you a way to begin to systematically analyze this incredibly chaotic and complex phenomenon that is war. And, you know, starting with the masters of war, starting with the thinkers who went through it, and also the ones that have endured. I mean, the more we think our world is too different, too complex to be amenable to anything, the more we need to sort of slow down and think through what war has passed and what thinkers passed, how they can help us sort of sort these problems we face today. I mean, these people had to deal with these incredibly complex situations and had to make these incredibly weighty decisions without the luxury of complete information. And that's the situation that our decision makers are going to be in the situation we're going to be in the future. So we have to sort of prepare them mentally for that.
Andrew Wilson earned his PhD in history from Harvard and teaches strategy and policy at the United States Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. If you're a military history buff, you'll find many more lectures on our video streaming service called The Great Courses Plus. Just visit thegreatcoursesplus.com/SiriusXM to sign up for a free trial. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/SiriusXM.
And that's it for today, boys and girls. Don't lose this. I would recommend that you keep it around and listen to it every once in a while, especially that about Michael Collins of the IRA. So I'll be back with you tomorrow, which is Thor's Day. In the meantime, think white, act white, be white. And I have nothing to say.